Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 1 through 22, the entire chapter, which I will entitle New Tablets of Stone and a New Heart. We're going to talk about the circumcision of a heart in this chapter. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 9, Moses kept telling the people, you're going to get wealthy when you cross the Jordan River. You're going to conquer the giants in the land, but it's not because of your righteousness. So we entitled that chapter, Not Because of Your Righteousness. So we start now in Deuteronomy 10, verses 1 through 2. The Lord said to me at that time, cut two stone tablets like the first ones, and come to me on the mountain and make a wooden ark. I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets you broke, and you are to place them in the ark. Now, what time is Moses referring to here? Well, it's the end of his second 40-day fast, and some people say there's three 40-day fasts. I don't think so. We'll just take it as two 40-day fasts at the end of that time. So at the end of that fast, God tells Moses, cut two stone tablets like the first one. Now, we need to remember here that the order of events that Moses recounts here in Deuteronomy is different than the order of events in Exodus. I think Moses is just picking and choosing events, not necessarily going in chronological order. The NIV Study Bible points out. Now, this ark that he's supposed to put the new stone tablets in is a chest, because that's what the Hebrew word means. In fact, the NIV Bible translated chest for a while, translated the word as chest for a while, but let me read you a quote, and I unfortunately lost the site, but whoever said this, quote, both words translate the same Hebrew word, which means chest or box. In other words, chest or ark, both of those English words translate the same Hebrew word. After initially translating chest for clarity, the NIV reverts to the more traditional and familiar reading, ark. And I think that had something to do with sales. People didn't like, what are you calling the ark? The ark of the covenant is the chest of the covenant? Give me a break. Which just shows, you know, when words get used a long time, we get familiar with them, even though they're weird words. I think ark was a bad King James translation of chest that happened back in the 1600s, and it just carried through into our culture. Now, which ark is it? As John Gill says, there's some options there. It could be Bezalel's. Bezalel is also known as Bezalel. That was the ark which was put into the tabernacle. This ark is called Moses' ark because Moses gave the order to Bezalel to make the ark. Well, that makes sense to me. It's the ark, the one that's in the tabernacle. But Gill says it could also be an ark made after Bezalel's ark. A second ark was used to be taken to battle, or it was another ark that was a temporary ark to be used while Bezalel was finishing the permanent ark. Well, that's just a bunch of highfalutin speculation. It's the ark. It's the chest. It's the box that was put into the Holy of Holies that had the cherubim at each end made out of acacia wood and God. And that's the ark that contained the two stone tablets. The new stone tablets were put into the ark. The first stone tablets, if you recall, were shattered when Moses came down the mountain, saw the golden calf, and got angry. Bang! He broke the original tablets. So when God tells Moses in verse 1 to make a wooden ark, Moses didn't directly make it. He indirectly made it by asking Bezalel to make it. We go now to Deuteronomy 10, verses 3 through 5. So I, Moses, made an ark of acacia wood, cut two stone tablets like the first ones, and climbed the mountain with the two tablets in my hand. Then on the day of the assembly, the Lord wrote on the tablets what had been written previously, the Ten Commandments that he had spoken to you on the mountain from the fire. The Lord gave them to me, and I went back down the mountain and placed the tablets in the ark I had made, and they have remained there as the Lord commanded me. Now Moses is said to have made the ark, he says in verse 3, so I made an ark. Actually, more precisely, he ordered Bezalel to make it. Exodus 37:1. Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood, 40 inches long, 27 inches wide, and 27 inches high. It was made out of acacia wood. The King James has shittim wood. I think acacia sounds a little bit more elegant. This was a common wood back there in the area. Hard, dark brown wood, sort of impervious to water. So Bezalel made this acacia wood, cut two stone tablets like the first one. John Gill says these stone tablets were probably marble. The stone was probably marble because there were great quantities of that around in the area. And the two new tablets were placed in the ark, verse 5. That is originally told us in Exodus 25:16. God tells Moses, put the tablets of the testimony that I will give you into the ark. The testimony, of course, being the law. We go now to Deuteronomy 10, verses 6 through 9. The Israelites traveled from Bitteroth Benejachon to Moserah. Aaron died and was buried there, and Eleazar his son became priest in his place. They traveled from there to Gudgada, and from Gudgada to Jotbatha, a land with streams of water. At that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the ark of the Lord's covenant, to stand before Yahweh, to serve him, and to pronounce blessings in his name, as it is today. For this reason, and today, of course, is on the plains of Moab, 38-plus years after the departure from Mount Sinai, 40 years since the departure from Egypt. For this reason, Levi does not have a portion or an inheritance like his brothers. The Lord is his inheritance, as the Lord your God told him. Now, verses 6 through 9 present a problem, two problems. First of all, it has nothing to do with what Moses is talking about. It's a parenthesis. More precisely, an historical parenthesis. And the question is why? Why does Moses put a parenthesis here right in the middle of his text? That's the first problem. Second problem, these place names that I just mentioned are not in the same order when the Israelites' campsites are mentioned in Numbers 33. The order for two of them is different. So we'll look at the two problems separately, and this is a problem that is extremely complicated. This is what PhD students in Old Testaments might work with, and I'm not such a person. So I'll just give you a summary of it, of the problem, and give you a proposed solution. Let's start with the first problem. Why the parenthesis in the middle of the text here? Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. So sudden a change from a spoken discourse to a historical narrative has greatly puzzled the most eminent Bible scholars, some of whom reject the parenthesis as a manifest interpolation. In other words, they say that that's not part of the scripture. But it is found in the most ancient Hebrew manuscripts, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, and believing that all contained in this book was given by inspiration and is entitled to profound respect, we must receive it as it stands, though acknowledging our inability to explain the insertion of these encampment details in this place. Well, that's the first problem. Well, let's just take the first problem first, that these verses are an interpolation. Well, that would mean the scripture's got error in it. But if you take it as these scriptures are part of a text that's been in the process of editing, misplaced from another place in the scripture, which all inerrantists know happens from time to time, well, then that would explain it. Let me give you a quote by the scholar Kennicott, who is quoted by Adam Clark. Quote, as they, these verses, 6 through 9, as they contain nothing singular or peculiar, are of no particular importance, and relate to no subject of disputation, they are not likely to have arisen from fraud or design. But perfectly coinciding in sense with other passages, they may safely be considered as another instance of a large transposition, 86 words, in the present text arising from accident and want of care. So it's not an interpolation according to Clark, it's a transposition, a misplacement of the text in editing, not in the writing of the text. Well, I think that's the easiest way to explain that. Although, of course, some scholars try to explain a logical reason why Moses put the words here. I'm not going to get into that. It's way over my head or interest. Now let's look at the second problem the verses 6 through 9 present. Two of the place names are in reverse order from Numbers 33. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Quote, there's another difficulty in the narrative itself. The stations which the Israelites are said successively to have occupied are enumerated here in a different order from Numbers 33, verse 31. That the names of the stations in both passages are the same here, there can be no doubt. But in Numbers, they are probably mentioned in reference to the first visit of the Hebrews during the long wandering southwards, before they return to Kadesh the second time, while here they have a reference to the second passage of the Israelites when they again march south in order to compass the land of Edom. Now, let me unpack Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown a little bit to make this clear what he's saying. First of all, we go to Numbers 33, 31 through 33, and we read there, they departed from Moseroth and camped at Benejachon. They departed from Benejachon and camped at Hor-Haggidgad. They departed from Hor Haggidgad and camped at Jotbatha. Well, the first problem we have is the place names are different. Well, that's because Hor Haggidgad is the same thing as Gudgada. This is according to BibleAtlas.org. In fact, most commentators say that. All right, so let's compare the different sequences. Now, in Numbers 33, 31 through 33, we have the sequences this way. 1, Mazareth. 2, Beneyakin. 3, Gudgada, which is Hor Haggidgad. And 4, Jotbatha. But in Deuteronomy 10, 6 through 7, which is our verses that we're looking at now, we have Beneyakin first and Mazareth second. Gudgada and Jotbatha are in the same order. So basically, you're talking about two place names in reverse. Numbers 33, 31, Mazareth goes first, then Beneyakin. Deuteronomy 10, 6 and 7, Beneyakin goes first, Mazareth second. How do you reconcile that? Well, if you recall, the Israelites, when they got to Kadesh Barnea, that was where they refused the report of Joshua and Caleb and listened to the report of the bad spies. God, as a result, says, all right, you're going to have to retreat now and go south to the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea. And so they left Kadesh and went south down to Eilat at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. All right. But then they went back north from Eilat. This is according to one view of the route of the Exodus, went back to Kadesh, and then they headed south from Kadesh again to get around Edom. That's when they went through that Punon Pass there in the north, according to some views. Now, of course, that's the route of the Exodus is controverted like crazy, and so that reconciliation might work. But it just in general, if you just say, okay, they were up there around these places, and they at one time they went through them in one order, and the other time they went through them in the reverse order, which is perfectly reasonable, that would explain the differences in order. Okay, let's continue in verse 6. One of the places they stopped at was Mosorah, and it says Aaron died there. Well, you say, I thought Aaron died at Mount Hor. Well, Mosorah was near Mount Hor. Let me give you some further description of Mosorah. This is from, well, I don't know where it's from. I didn't write down the site. I think it's BibleAtlas.org. Mosorah, quote, which means a bond, one of the stations of the Israelites in the wilderness at the foot of Mount Hor. It has been identified with El Taiba, a small fountain at the bottom of the pass leading to the ascent of Mount Hor. Well, considering that Mount Hor is itself not certainly identified, but Mosorah is at the bottom of Mount Hor, the best I can do here, and so that's why it said that Moses died there, because Mosorah was at Mount Hor. How do we know Moses died at Mount Hor? Numbers 20, verses 25 through 26. Take Aaron and Eleazar, his son, and bring them up into Mount Hor. And strip Aaron of his garments and put them upon Eleazar, his son, and Aaron shall be gathered unto his people and shall die there. That's the passing of the high priesthood from Aaron to Eleazar at Aaron's death. Now a little time note in verse 8. Moses says, at that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the ark. Well, what time is it? Well, it has to be after the construction of the tabernacle, which, if I recall correctly, was the last 2 months of the first year out of the Exodus, and then the Levites were appointed to carry the ark which had been constructed. It can't refer to at that time, the time that Aaron died at Mosorah at Mount Hor, because that was 38 plus years later, after the tribe of Levi was appointed to carry the ark of the Lord's covenant. As John Gill says, speaking of ark of the covenant, covenant there is another word for the law, because the covenant is the Mosaic law, the old covenant, as the book of Hebrews said. Now in verse 8 it says that the Levites were appointed to bless the people. At that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to stand before Yahweh to serve him and to pronounce blessings in his name. So the Levites were blessers. Now John Gill says that there's some options as to what that means. When it says that the Levites were to bless the people, he says it can't be blessing the people directly, because the priest blessed the people, not the Levites. So he says that blessing the people there is really blessing God by singing praise to him. Well, that's nice, except the text says they blessed the people, so I'm not going to worry about that too much. Let's assume the priest and the Levites blessed the people. It's something we don't think about often. We think of the Levites as singers. They were security guards. They were helpers in the cooking of the sacrifices and all of that. But they were also blessers. They blessed the people. We go now to Deuteronomy 10, verses 10 through 13. This is Moses still talking to the people on the plains of Moab. I didn't mention this. This is in his second discourse of his three discourses to the people of Israel right before he died. I stayed on the mountains, that's Mount Sinai, 40 days and 40 nights like the first time. Remember, there was two 40-day fasts. One while he was receiving the first set of two tables of the law, and after those were broken, he's getting the new tables of the law, another 40 days and 40 night fast. I bet he didn't want the Israelites to break it the third time, or to cause him to have to break it the third time. 40 days and 40 nights without eating. Great day. The Lord also listened to me on this occasion. He agreed not to annihilate you. Then the Lord said to me, get up, continue your journey ahead of the people, so that they may enter and possess the land I swore to give their fathers. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you except to fear the Lord your God by walking in all his ways, to love him, and to worship the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul? There you see, God is a personal God who loves the Israelites. Verse 13, Deuteronomy 10, keep the Lord's commands and statutes I am giving you today for your own good. Moses says that the Israelites are to fear the Lord by walking in all his ways. In verse 17, this is a common refrain in Deuteronomy. Let's look at Deuteronomy 11:22. For if you carefully observe every one of these commands I am giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, walk in all his ways, and remain faithful to him. And of course, this verse probably sounds like a more famous verse that is quoted all the time. Micah 6:8. Mankind, he has told you what is good and what it is the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God. Now, all this walking according to the laws are to have a good result. He says, keep the Lord's commands and statutes for your own good. It's not only for God's glory, but also for the Israelites' own good. The purpose of the law is not to restrict people's freedom. It's only children and modern-day liberals who think that. Here's some scriptures showing that good things come to those who walk in God's commands. Deuteronomy 6:2. Do this so that you may fear the Lord your God all the days of your life by keeping all his statutes and commands I am giving you, your son and your grandson. Why? And so that you may have a long life. So you keep the statutes, your life is long. Now again, you always have the problem, is that talking about Israelites in general, or is it talking about each individual? Because some people accidentally get killed, you know, before their life is over. But basically it means if you obey the commandments of the Lord, good things are going to happen. You're going to be healthier. You're not going to have jealous husbands coming after you because you seduced their wives, coming after you to kill you. And if you don't think that happens, it happens all the time. You don't steal, so therefore you don't get shot by the cops while you're trying to rob a bank, and so forth. Deuteronomy 6:24, the Lord commanded us to follow all these statutes and to fear the Lord our God for our prosperity, always, and for our preservation, as it is today. So prosperity and preservation come from following the commands of the Lord. And of course, today, New Testament Christians are under the commands of Christ, the law of Christ. His commands lead to good things, just as the Old Testament did. Prosperity, preservation, long life. As a matter of fact, the law of Christ incorporated a lot of the law of Moses anyway. Same idea. You obey God, good things happen because of that. Not that you have a life of characterized by lying around in rose petals, but you... Life is always hard for everybody, but God gives you victory over the challenges, and you have a long life and prosperity. Keep the commandments. Deuteronomy 10, verses 14 through 16. The heavens, indeed the highest heavens, belong to the Lord your God, as does the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord was devoted to your fathers and loved them. He chose their descendants after them. He chose you out of all the peoples, as it is today. Therefore, circumcise your hearts and don't be stiff-necked any longer. Well, let's start with verse 14. What does it mean, the heavens? Well, the word is plural in the original Hebrew, and most commentators say that there were that the ancient world considered three heavens. First is the atmosphere where the birds fly. The second heaven is outer space where the planets rotate and move and the stars move around in. And the third heavens is where God and the angels live. And I think that makes perfectly good sense. However, Adam Clark disagrees. He says the heavens are gradations in outer space. Let me read you his quote. To say that the first heaven means the atmosphere, the second the planetary system, and the third the region of the blessed is saying but very little in the way of explanation. So Adam Clark has just said, I've not explained that very well. Well, I disagree. The words were probably intended to point out the immensity of God's creation, in which we may readily conceive of one system of heavenly bodies, and others beyond them, and others still, an endless progression through the whole vortex of space, every star in the vast abyss of nature being a sun with its peculiar and numerous attendant worlds. Thus, there may be systems of systems in endless gradation up to the throne of God. Well, so Adam Clark tends to think that the phrase heavens is referring to the physical universe, outer space, the cosmos. I don't think so. I think when it says the heavens, indeed, the highest heavens and highest heavens is the King James's heaven of heavens, but the highest heavens means the third heaven. That's the heaven where God lives. First heaven is where the birds fly, the atmosphere. The second heavens is where the planets rotate, and the third heavens is where God lives. All right. All of the heavens belong to God, the physical as well as the spiritual, as does the earth. So heaven and earth all belong to God. Verse 15, yet the Lord was devoted to your fathers. What does that mean, yet? Yet means even. Even despite the fact that the heavens belong to God, despite that fact that shows that God is so elevated above the human race and above the Israelites, even despite that fact, God condescended to come down, devote himself to the patriarchs, the Jewish patriarchs, and to love them. And despite the fact that they're so sinful and so pathetic, and God is so incredibly awesome, despite that fact, he chose the patriarchs' descendants after them, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 patriarchs. And then it comes down to you, Israelites, who are getting ready to come into the land of Israel. He chose you out of all the people, despite the fact that you did nothing but sin, as Moses said earlier in his speech, or speeches, you have done nothing but sin from the first day I knew you. You've never stopped sinning. So the contrast is awesome, is it not? So Moses says in verse 16, look, therefore, because God bothered to choose you, despite the fact that you weren't worth it, circumcise your hearts. Now, of course, the Israelites were already circumcised physically. Circumcision was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. Genesis 17:10, this is my covenant which are to keep between me and you and your offspring after you. That's God speaking. Every one of your males must be circumcised. So they had already been circumcised. So why did Moses tell them again, you need to be circumcised in your heart? Well, because he's using physical circumcision as a metaphor for spiritual circumcision, if you will. And we will show that as we see how the idea of circumcising the heart is carried over into the New Testament. Before we do that, though, let's look some more about the physical circumcision. Why was it the sign of God's covenant with Abraham? Well, commentators and scholars will discuss this back and forth. The NIV Study Bible says that circumcision reflected the self-maledictory oath that was always carried out in covenants, where you would cross your heart and hope to die. If I don't keep this covenant with you, I'll split my stomach open. As the NIV Study Bible says, quote, this is the way it went, quote, if I am not loyal in faith and obedience to the Lord, may the sword of the Lord cut off from me and my offspring. Because if you circumcise, that's the symbol of, that's cutting off foreskins from the penis from which the semen comes, which provides descendants, which would, of course, keep the covenant going. Because that's part of the covenant, many, many descendants as the sand of the seashore and the stars of the sky. So what Abraham is doing when he circumcises himself, according to this view, he's saying, hey, may I cut off all my descendants if I don't remain faithful to God's covenant. Well, that's reasonable. I like to look at it, the circumcision is a symbol of the weakness of man's flesh. In other words, God's going to fulfill his promise of offspring to Abraham, but it's not going to come through Abraham's flesh. His flesh was cut, which means, symbolically means that it's not through the power of Abraham that children are born. It's through God. Of course, the very first child was born when he was 100 years old, which also shows his weakness and the power of God. So anyway, that's the symbolism, the cutting off of natural prosperity and the pride and the flesh that comes from that if Abraham doesn't obey the covenant. So that explains why circumcision is the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, other nations also promised circumcision as the practice circumcision, as the NIV Study Bible says. So circumcision was not all that unique. However, circumcision in conjunction with such an incredible promise as was given to Abraham, land, offspring, and blessings, that was unique. Now, some skeptics, as Adam Clark say, like to say that Egypt did it first, circumcision first, and so Israel just got it from Egypt, so it's no big deal. Well, some possible answers to that. Well, no, the Egyptians could have learned it from the Israelites when Joseph and his family sojourned there. I think more likely is maybe Egypt did it first, but God adopted the custom for divine reasons. The Egyptians had no covenant reasons behind their circumcision. At any rate, circumcision became a symbol of spiritual humility and purity, even in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 10:16, which is where we are now. Circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. And again, this is Moses talking about your internal attitude, your heart. Be holy on the inside. Be humble. Be pure. And the idea of circumcision as a symbol of humility and purity is carried over into the New Testament by the Apostle Paul. Let's read Romans 2:25-29. For indeed, circumcision is of value if you practice the law. But if you are a transgressor of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. And what Paul is saying there, just because you're outwardly circumcised, if you go around robbing banks, it doesn't matter. Your circumcision doesn't mean a thing. You might as well be like an uncircumcised Gentile. Verse 26. So if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? And so this is the opposite case. You got a righteous Gentile who's not robbing banks. So he might as well be said to be circumcised, even though physically he's not. So again, we're looking at the spiritual import of the heart as opposed to the outward fleshly appearance of the flesh. Verse 27, Paul continues, and he who is physically uncircumcised, if he keeps the law, will he not judge you, though having the letter of the law and circumcision? Though having the letter of the law and circumcision, you are a transgressor of the law. In other words, the Gentiles, they're not circumcised, they're uncircumcised, but they keep the law. Hey, they're better off than you Jews who are circumcised but not keeping the law. Verse 28, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. In other words, circumcised. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God. So Paul is trying to move his readers from the old covenant, the old Mosaic covenant, to the new covenant, away from reliance on fleshly rituals, outward rituals, going to the internal attitude of the heart. And notice Moses is doing the same thing, even in the Old Testament, even in his own law. Deuteronomy 10:16, circumcise your heart. Let's look at Romans 4:11. And he received the sign of circumcision, that would be Abraham, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised. Abraham believed even before he got circumcised. So that's what's important, faith, his faith. He received the sign of circumcision so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them. I think this is fairly easy, unless you're a legalist or a Judaizer, to show that we're not under all the Old Testament laws. We are now circumcised in our heart, not in our flesh. Colossians 2:11, and in him you also were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. A circumcision made without hands. Well, no penis ever got circumcised without hands. Not possible. So we Christians are circumcised in a heart. We are made members of the new covenant by the circumcision of Christ, because Christ lives in our heart. Moses also tells the people of Israel not to be stiff-necked, in the same verse that he says they are to be circumcised in their heart. Stiff-necked is a metaphor that refers to a heifer, a young cow who's unaccustomed to the yoke. So the farmer tries to put the yoke on the little cow, and the cow stiffens his neck and backs out of the yoke. He wriggles his neck out of it. Very aggravating. Well, God wants the people of Israel to wear his yoke because, to put it in Jesus' word, God's yoke is easy and his burden is light. It actually helps the cow pull the load because it evens out the foot pounds that are used to pull the load behind. If you don't have a yoke, one bull will pull to the left and one will pull to the right. As a result, the plow doesn't go forward. So a yoke is a good thing. And the people of Israel were stiff-necked and were not taking the yoke of God. Some other places in the scriptures, Old Testament, in the Torah, where stiff-necked is used to describe the Israelites, Deuteronomy 9:6. Understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. Deuteronomy 31:27. For I know how rebellious and stiff-necked you are. If you are rebelling against the Lord now, while I am still alive, how much more will you rebel after I am dead? Well, there's a vote of confidence for the Israelites. I guess Moses had seen enough in 40 years of dealing with these people. Exodus 32:9, the Lord also said to Moses, I have seen this people, and they are indeed a stiff-necked people. And God puts his stamp of approval on Moses' opinion. Yep, they're stiff-necked. We go now to Deuteronomy 10, verses 17 through 19. For the Lord your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, mighty, and awesome God, showing no partiality and taking no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner, giving him food and clothing. You also must love the foreigner, since you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. Now when it says that God is the God of gods, when Moses says that to the people, what does the little g gods mean there? Well, it could be idols. I think that's what it is. John Gill says it could be angels, because angels are sometimes called gods, so he's the God of angels. I don't think so. Now, gods also refers to civil magistrates, who are sometimes called gods, and we know that. Remember Kenneth Copeland saying, you are gods. He's misquoting Jesus, who was talking about gods in the sense of civil leaders. And, of course, Kenneth Copeland is talking about gods in the sense of little demigods who are half divine. He's a heretic. Mark my words for it. But anyway, the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords. And lords there means secular princes and kings of the world. He's head over them all. He's an awesome God showing no partiality. And it's interesting that in the midst of all these superlative titles for God, he's described as someone who shows no partiality. I am convinced that Moses, since Moses was a lawgiver, he was in charge of the court system, and a lot of his laws, of course, had to do with legal things. He was very sensitive to what it took to have a just legal system, and one of the things you need to do in order to have a just legal system is you have to have impartial judges. I remember talking to one of the most, in fact, he was said to be the most successful lawyer in Shanghai. I was eating with him, and he had quit to try to get his PhD in law. And I said, why did you quit being a lawyer? You were so successful. He said, because all law was in Shanghai was taking the judges out to eat and offering them presents and gifts and bribes. It's a horrible thing when the judicial system is corrupted. But God is a God that shows no partiality, and of course he takes no bribe. And of course the idea there is that God is the exemplar of how Israel's human judges should be. When he says he shows no partiality, he further describes that in verse 18. How does he show no partiality? He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow. In other words, just because somebody's an orphan or a widow, they have no social status, they probably have no money, doesn't matter. They get justice. And the foreigner, God loves the foreigner, and what it means is he gives justice to the foreigner. The sojourner in Israel, of course, foreigners never have as much rights as local citizens. I was a foreigner for 23 years in China. I know how that is. And so God gives food and clothing even to the foreigner. And then he says in verse 19, you must love the foreigner since you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. And of course, the host country of Egypt did not treat the guest Israelites very well. Here's a psalm illustrating the idea that God is the God of the fatherless. Psalm 68, verse 5, a father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in his holy habitation. In verse 19, Moses says this, you also must love the foreigner since you are foreigners in the land of Egypt. And what he's doing there is he's asking the Israelites to identify with people in pain. You are a foreigner, so think about what it's like when you got foreigners in your land. How easy it is to forget that. Think about poor people who were poor and experienced the pain of poverty, then they get rich and they completely forget what it's like to be poor, and so they treat poor people terribly. That's sort of a common thing that sinful human beings do. We go now to Deuteronomy 10, verses 20 through 22, and we'll finish this chapter. You are to fear Yahweh your God and worship him. Remain faithful to him and take oaths in his name. He is your praise and he is your God, who has done for you these great and awesome works your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 people in all, and was the Lord. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of the sky. Now that phrase there, remain faithful to God. The King James translates the Hebrew as cleave. And of course, that reminds us of the famous leave and cleave verse. Well, let's look at the NASB translations of that word. And they translate it as, that translation translates it as join to or hold fast or cling. Genesis 2:24, for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife. That's what the King James calls cleave to his wife. That's a closeness that's beyond just an ordinary association. Remain faithful is just sort of a plain vanilla translation from Holman Christian Study Bible, but I like the idea of holding fast, cling to the Lord your God. Ruth 1:14. And they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her, squeezed her tight, just like we're supposed to squeeze Yahweh tight. Deuteronomy 4:4. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. You held fast, you clung to them desperately. Deuteronomy 11:22, for if you are careful to keep all this commandment which I am commanding you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and hold fast to him, cleave to him, cling to him. Deuteronomy 13:4, you shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him and cling to him. Don't let him go. Deuteronomy 30:20, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice and by holding fast to him, for this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. You're supposed to love the Lord your God by obeying his voice and by holding fast to him. That's how you show you love God, by holding fast to him, by clinging to him. That's how Ruth and Orpah, her mother-in-law, how they showed their love for one another. They clung to each other. In verse 20, the Israelites are said to take oaths in God's name. And that's interesting. Take oaths in God's name. And encouragement to take an oath. Of course, we're here today because of the Anabaptist tradition of the Mennonites and the Amish that influence, where they have managed to cast a negative light on taking oaths. There's nothing wrong with taking oaths. In fact, they're encouraged here. Take oaths in God's name. Now, that doesn't mean rash oaths. It means serious oaths. Jesus, in fact, in the Sermon on the Mount, forbade false oaths, where people will give these tricky oaths so they could get out of the oath. Well, of course, but a sincere oath, God says, swear in God's name, no problem. Verse 21, Moses says that God has done for you these great and awesome works your eyes have seen. Well, what have their eyes seen? Well, their fathers saw the deliverance from the Red Sea, and they themselves personally saw the destruction of the two Amorite kings of the Transjordan, Og and Heshbon, Sihon and Heshbon, king of the Amorites, and the northern Amorite king, Og of Bashan. They had seen the great victory over those kings, not to mention the battle over the Midianites, who had allied themselves with the Moabites, who were trying to give the Israelites grief as they tried to get into the Promised Land. The people had seen all this. And so that's one thing it's always good to do. If you start getting shaky in your faith or whatever, just look at what God's done. And the more he does for you, the more you believe him, even though things might be tough in the present. Verse 22, Moses continues his historical perspective. He says, your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 people in all, and now you are as numerous as the stars of the sky, 70 to an uncountable number. In other words, God has increased you, and that was part of the Abrahamic covenant, was it not? Land, offspring. And blessings to the nation, so the offspring promise is being fulfilled. Has been fulfilled, Israelites, right in front of your eyes. Now in verse 22 we read, your fathers went down to Egypt. Moses is talking to the people of Israel, and he says, your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 people in all. He's referring to when Jacob took his descendants and went down to Egypt in order to escape the famine in Israel at the invitation of Joseph to get the family down to Egypt. 70 people in all. Now there is a problem here, because the Septuagint version of this verse, quoted by Stephen in Acts chapter 7, said there were 75 people that came. So let's go back to Genesis 46, verses 26 through 27, and read what the Masoretic text says. Verse 26, the total number of persons belonging to Jacob, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, who came to Egypt, 66, and Joseph's sons who were born to him in Egypt, 2 persons, that would be Ephraim and Manasseh, and all those of Jacob's household who had come to Egypt, 70 persons. All right, well, first of all, we've got to reconcile the 66 and the 70, and that's not so hard to do. Before we do that, let's read also in Exodus 1:5, the total number of Jacob's descendants was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. So there's another description of the number of Jacob's descendants as 70. Now, why is this number different than 66? Well, there's a couple ways you can get from 66 to 70. First of all, you can take the listing there in Genesis 46, which lists all of Jacob's descendants by name, and it gives you a total, gives you a subtotal of 66 in Genesis 46, 26, and then in Genesis 46, 27, it gives you the total of 70. Now, how do we get from 66 to 70? Well, if you take the list of names at 70, you take out Ur and Onan in verse 12, take them out, because they died before Jacob went down to Egypt. That gets you down to 68. And then if you exclude Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born by their father Joseph while they were already in Egypt, so they didn't go to Egypt, that gets you down to 66. Now, this way of calculating 66 would assume that Jacob and Joseph are in the list of 70. There are other ways to reconcile the 66 and 70 number. You can subtract Ephraim and Manasseh out. That's a no-brainer because they were already down in Egypt. That's 68. And then instead of subtracting out Ur and Onan, you can subtract out Joseph because he was in Egypt too. Well, at least he wasn't in Egypt originally, but he went down there. He was forced to go to Egypt as he was taken into slavery and sent to Egypt. But you don't count him because he was already down there. And then you don't count Jacob because he's not a descendant of Jacob. He can't be his own descendant. And so then you leave Ur and Onan in and take out Joseph and Jacob, Ephraim and Manasseh, and you get 66. Well, then I have a problem with that. Why would you then include Ur and Onan since they were dead prior to entry? So I think it makes more sense just to exclude Ur and Onan because they're dead, Ephraim and Manasseh because they're already in Egypt, and you get 66 that went down there to Egypt. Now, that's the easiest problem. The other problem is that Stephen quotes the Septuagint here and says that there were 75 that went down to Egypt. Genesis 46:20, the Septuagint adds one son of Manasseh, two of Ephraim, and one grandson of each Manasseh and Ephraim for a total of 75. So Stephen says in Acts 7:14 that Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. Well, the easiest way to reconcile it is to say that they use different texts. But then the next question is, well, which text is accurate, the Masoretic text or the Septuagint text? And I've read an article on this. It's extremely complicated. There are ways to reconcile the two numbers, 70 and 75, but it's not worth going into the discussion of it because it's very, very complicated. Some people say that, well, 70 is a literary number. It's the ideal and complete number for Jacob's descendants in Egypt. And that the 70 would have been precisely accurate had Ur and Onan not died earlier. Well, literary numbers, I prefer the more precise numbers. I'll just leave it here and say that they quoted different texts. Which one's right? That's a matter for the PhDs in Old Testament. Now, however you count the numbers that went down to Egypt, the number was small, whether it was 70 or 75, very small. But now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of the sky, as Moses said. And of course, he's referring to the famous covenant promise made to Abraham, Genesis 15:5. He, that's God, took him, Abram. He took Abram outside and said, look at the sky and count the stars if you're able to count them. Then he said to him, God said to Abram, your offspring will be that numerous. In other words, uncountable. So that's the point. We're going from a small number to a big number. Moses is trying to recount all the blessings of God that God has visited upon the Israelites. And so he's saying, be confident, cross that river, beat the giants, take the cities that are fortified with walls as high as heaven, and inherit the land and establish God's covenant, his Abrahamic covenant. Do it. Ladies and gentlemen, on that happy note, we have finished Deuteronomy 10, and now that prepares us to go to Deuteronomy 11, verses 1 through 32, which I have tentatively entitled, Love and Serve the Lord. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.